His voice was as a clap of wrathful thunder, and the courts rang. But the envoy, unabashed, uttered his message, saying, "The Lord Melko, ruler of the world from the darkest east to the outer slopes of the mountains of Valinor, and to his kinsmen the Ainur. Behold, in compensation for divers grievous affronts, and for long times of unjust imprisonment, despite his noble estate and blood that he has at your hands suffered, now has he taken, as is due to him, certain small treasures held by the Noldoli, your slaves. Great grief is it to him, that of these he has slain some, in that they would do him hurt in the evil of their heart. Yet their blasphemous intent will he now put from memory, and all the past injuries that ye the gods have wrought him will he so far forget as once again to show his presence in that place that is called Valmar, if ye will hearken to his conditions and fulfil them. For know that the Noldoli shall be his servants, and shall adorn him a house. Moreover of right, he does demand..." But hereon, even as the herald lifted up his voice, yet louder swelling with his words of insolence, so great became the wrath of the Valar, that Tulkas and several of his house leapt down and, seizing him, stopped his mouth, and the place of council was in uproar. Indeed, Melko had not thought to gain aught but time and the confusion of the Valar by this embassage of insolence. Then Manwe bid him unhand the herald, but the guards arose, crying with one voice, "This is no herald, but a rebel, a thief, and a murderer." "He hath defiled the sanctity of Valinor," shouted Tulkas, "and cast his insolence in our teeth." Now the mind of all the elves was as one in this matter. Hope they had none of the recovery of the jewels, save by the capture of Melko, which was now a matter beyond hope. But they would have no parley with Melko whatsoever, and would treat him as an outlaw, and all his folk. And this was the meaning of Manwe, saying that the death of Bruithwir would be the root of the greatest evil, for it was that slaying that most inflamed both gods and elves. Note 8. To this end, they spoke in the ears of Varda and Aule, and Varda befriended their cause before Manwe, and Aule yet more stoutly, for his heart was sore too for the theft of so many things of exquisite craft and workmanship. But Tulkas Poldoria needed no pleading, being hot with ire. Now these great advocates moved the council with their words, so that in the end it is Manwe's doom that word be sent back to Melko, rejecting him and his words, and outlawing him and all his followers from Valinor forever. These words would he now speak to the envoy, bidding him begone to his master with them, but the folk of the valley and the elves would have none of it, and led by Tulkas, they took that renegade to the topmost peak of Taniquetil, and there declaring him no herald, and taking the mountain and the stars to witness of the same, they cast him to the boulders of Arvalien, so that he was slain. And Mandos received him into his deepest cave. Then Manwe, seeing in this rebellion and their violent deed the seed of bitterness, cast down his scepter and wept. But the others spake unto Sorontur, king of eagles upon Taniquetil, and by him were the words of Manwe sent to Melko. "Begone forever, O accursed, nor dare to parley more with gods or elves. Neither shall thy foot, nor that of any who serve thee, tread the soil of Valinor again, while the world endures." And Sorontur sought out Melko, and said as he was bidden, and of the death of his envoy he told too. Then Melko would have slain Sorontur, being mad with anger at the death of his messenger. And verily this deed was not in accord with the strict justice of the gods, yet was the anger of those at Valmar sorely tempted. But Melko has ever cast it against the gods most bitterly, twisting it into a black tale of wrong. And between that evil one and Sorontur has there ever since been hate and war, and that was most bitter when Sorontur and his folk fared to the Iron Mountains and their abode, watching all that Melko did. Now Aule goeth to Manwe, and speaketh in heartening words, saying how Valmar still stands, and the mountains are high and a sure bulwark against evil. Lo, if Melko sets once more turmoils in the world, was he not bound in chains aforetime, and so may be again? But behold, Soon will I and Tulkas fill that pass that leads to Erumani and the seas, that Melko come not ever that way hither again. But Manwe and Aule plan to set guards about all those mountains, until such time as Melko's deeds and places of abode without become known. Then does Aule fall to speech with Manwe concerning the Noldoli, and he pleads much for them, saying that Manwe, wrought with anxiety, has done hardly by them. For that of Melko, in sooth, alone is the evil come, whereas the Eldar are not slaves nor servants, but beings of a wondrous sweetness and beauty, that they were guests forever of the gods. Therefore does Manwe bid them now, and they will, go back to Kor, and if they so desire, busy themselves in fashioning gems and fabrics anew, and all things of beauty and cost that they may need in their labour shall be given to them even more lavishly than before. But when Fëanor heard this saying, he said, Yea, but who shall give us back the joyous heart, without which works of loveliness and magic cannot be? And Brithwyr is dead, and my heart also. Many, nonetheless, went then back to Kor, and some semblance of old joy is then restored, though for the lessened happiness of their hearts, their labours do not bring forth gems of the old lustre and glory. But Fëanor dwelt in sorrow with a few folk in Sir Numen, and though he sought day and night to do so, he could in no wise make other jewels like to the Silmarils of old that Melko snatched away, nor indeed has any craftsman ever done so since. At length does he abandon the attempt, sitting rather beside the tomb of Brithwyr, that is called the Mound of the First Sorrow, and is well named for all the woe that came from the death of him who was laid there. Footnote: the Mound of the First Sorrow. In the margin are written gnomish names, Cum Agumleth or Cum Athagranaithos. End of footnote. There brooded Fëanor bitter thoughts, till his brain grew dazed by the black vapours of his heart, and he arose and went to Kor. There did he speak to the gnomes, dwelling on their wrongs and sorrows, and their minished wealth and glory, bidding them leave this prison house and get them into the world. As cowards have the Valar become, but the hearts of the Eldar are not weak, and we will see what is our own, and if we may not get it by stealth, we will do so by violence. There shall be war between the children of Ilúvatar and Ainu Melko. What if we perish in our quest? The dark halls of Ve be little worse than this bright prison. Note 9. And he prevailed thus upon some to go before Manwe with himself, and demand that the Noldoli be suffered to leave Valinor in peace, and set safely by the gods upon the shores of the world, whence they had of old been ferried. Then Manwe was grieved by their request, and forbade the gnomes to utter such words in Kor, if they desired still to dwell there among the other elves. But then, changing from harshness, he told them many things concerning the world and its fashion, and the dangers that were already there, and the worst that might soon come to be, by reason of Melko's return. My heart feels, and my wisdom tells me, said he, that no great age of time will now elapse, ere those other children of Ilúvatar, the fathers of men, do come into the world. And behold, it is of the unalterable music of the Ainur that the world come in the end, for a great while, under the sway of men. Yet whether it shall be for happiness or sorrow, Ilúvatar has not revealed, and I would not have strife or fear or anger come ever between the different children of Ilúvatar, and fain would I for many an age yet leave the world empty of beings who might strive against the new-come men and do hurt to them ere their clans be grown to strength, while the nations and peoples of the earth are yet infants. To this he added many words concerning men and their nature, and the things that would befall them, and the Noldoli were amazed, for they had not heard the Valar speak of men, save very seldom, and had not then heeded overmuch, deeming these creatures weak and blind and clumsy, and beset with death, nor in any ways likely to match the glory of the Eldalie. Now therefore, although Manwe had unburdened his heart in this way, hoping that the Noldoli, seeing that he did not labour without a purpose or a reason, would grow calmer and more trustful of his love, rather were they astonished to discover that the Ainur made the thought of men so great a matter, and Manwë's words achieved the opposite of his wish. For Fëanor, in his misery, twisted them into an evil semblance, when standing again before the throng of Kor, he spake these words: "Lo, now do we know the reason of our transportation hither, as it were cargoes of fair slaves. Now at length are we told to what end we are guarded here, robbed of our heritage in the world, ruling not the wide lands, lest perchance we yield them not to a race unborn. To these, forsooth, a sad folk beset with swift mortality, a race of borrowers in the dark, clumsy of hand, untuned to songs or musics, who shall dully labour at the soil with their rude tools. To these, whom still he says are of Ilúvatar, would Manwë Sulemo, lordling of the Ainur, give the world and all the wonders of its land, all its hidden substances, give it to these, that is our inheritance? Or what is this talk of the dangers of the world? A trick to deceive us, a mask of words. O all ye children of the Noldali, whomso will no longer be house thralls of the gods, however softly held, arise, I bid ye, and get you from Valinor, for now is the hour come, and the world awaits." In sooth it is a matter for great wonder, the subtle cunning of Melko, for in those wild words who shall say that there lurked not a sting of the minutest truth? Nor fail to marvel, seeing the very words of Melko pouring from Fëanor, his foe, who knew not nor remembered whence was the fountain of these thoughts. Yet perchance the outmost origin of these sad things was before Melko himself, and such things must be. And the mystery of the jealousy of elves and men is an unsolved riddle, one of the sorrows at the world's dim roots. Howso these deep things be, the fierce words of Fëanor got him instantly a mighty following, for a veil there seemed before the hearts of the gnomes, and mayhap even this was not without the knowledge of Ilúvatar. Yet would Melko have been rejoiced to hear it, seeing his evil giving fruit beyond his hopes. Now, however, that evil one wanders the dark plains of Eruman, and farther south than anyone had yet penetrated, he found a region of the deepest gloom, and it seemed to him a good place wherein for the time to hide his stolen treasure. Therefore he seeks, until he finds a dark cavern in the hills, and webs of darkness lie about, so that the black air might be felt heavy and choking about one's face and hands. Very deep and winding were those ways, having a subterranean outlet on the sea, as the ancient books say, and here on a time were the moon and sun imprisoned afterward. Note 10. For here dwelt the primeval spirit Moru, whom even the Valar know not whence or when she came, and the folk of earth have given her many names. Mayhap she was bred of mists and darkness on the confines of the shadowy seas, in that utter dark that came between the overthrow of the lamps and the kindling of the trees, but more like she has always been, and she it is who loveth still to dwell in that black place, taking the guise of an unlovely spider, spinning a clinging gossamer of gloom that catches in its mesh stars and moons and all bright things that sail the airs. Indeed, it was because of her labours that so little of that overflowing light of the two trees flowed ever into the world, for she sucked light greedily, and it fed her, but she brought forth only that darkness that is a denial of all light. Ungwe Lianti, the great spider who enmeshes, did the Eldar call her, naming her also Wirilome, or Gloom Weaver, whence still do the Noldoli speak of her as Ungoliant, the spider, or as Gwerlum the Black. Now between Melko and Ungwe Lianti was their friendship from the first, when she found him and his comrades straying in her caves. But Gloomweaver was a hungered of the brightness of that hoard of jewels, so soon as she saw them. Now Melko, having despoiled the Noldoli and brought sorrow and confusion into the realm of Valinor, thought less of that hoard than aforetime, having now conceived a darker and deeper plan of aggrandizement. Therefore, seeing the lust of Ungwe's eyes, he offers her all that hoard, saving only the 3 Silmarils, if she will abet him in his new design. This she granteth readily, And so came all that treasury of most lovely gems, fairer than any others that the world has seen, into the foul keeping of Wirilome, and was wound in webs of darkness and hidden deep in the caverns of the eastern slopes of the great hills that are the southern boundary of Eruman. Deeming that now is the time to strike while Valinor is yet in uproar, nor waiting for Aule and Tulkas to block the passage in the hills, Melkor and Wirilome crept into Valinor and lay hidden in a valley of the foothills until Silphion was in bloom. But all the while was Gloomweaver spinning her most lightless webs and ill-enchanted shade. These she let float down so that in place of the fair silver light of Silphion, all about the western plain of Valinor, there creeps now a dim, uncertain darkness, and faint lights waver in it. Then does she throw a black cloak of invisibility about Melkor and herself, and they steal across the plain, and the gods are in wonder, and the elves in Kor are afraid. Nonetheless, they do not as yet suspect the hand of Melkor in this, thinking rather it is some work of Ossi's, who at times, with his storms, caused great mists and darkness to be wafted off the shadowy seas, encroaching even the bright airs of Valinor, though in this he met the anger both of Ulmo and of Manwë. Then Manwë sent forth a sweet westerly breath, wherewith he was accustomed at such times to blow all sea-humours back eastward over the waters. But such gentle breathing availed nothing against the woven night heavy and clinging that Wirilome had spread far abroad. Thus was it that unmarked Melkor and the Spider of Night reached the roots of Laurelin, and Melkor, summoning all his godlike might, thrust a sword into its beauteous stock, and the fiery radiance that spouted forth assuredly had consumed him, even as it did his sword, had not Gloomweaver cast herself down and lapped it thirstily, plying even her lips to the wound in the tree's bark, and sucking away its life and strength. By a cursed fortune this deed was not straightway marked, for it was the time of Laurelin's accustomed deepest repose, and now, behold, nevermore would it wake to glory, scattering beauty and joy upon the faces of the gods. Because of that great draught of light suddenly pride surged in Gwerrum's heart, and she heeded not Melkor's warnings, but sat herself now nigh to the roots of Silphion, and spouted forth evil fumes of night that flowed like rivers of blackness even to the gates of Valmar. Now Melkor takes the weapon that remains to him, a knife, and will injure the bowl of Silphion as much as time will allow. But a gnome called Daurin, Torin, wandering from Sir Numen in great boding of ill, sees him and makes for him, crying aloud. So great was the onrush of that impetuous gnome, that ere Melkor is aware he has hewn at Wirilome, where in the likeness of a spider she sprawls upon the ground. Now the slender blade that Daurin wielded came from the forge of Aule and was steeped in Miruvor, or never had he done harm to that secret being, but now he cleaves one of her great legs, and his blade is stained with her black gore, a poison to all things whose life is light. Then Wirilome, writhing, throws a thread about him, and he may not get free, and Melkor ruthless stabs him. Then, wresting that bright slender blade from his dying grasp, he thrusts it deep into Silphion's trunk, and the poison of Gwerlum, black upon it, dried the very sap and essence of the tree, and its light died suddenly to a dismal glow lost in impenetrable dusk. Then did Melkor and Wirilome turn in flight, nor is it too soon, for some that were behind Daurin, seeing his fate, fled in terror both to Kor and Valmar, stumbling madly in the darkness, but indeed already the Valar are riding forth upon the plain, speeding as fast as may be, yet too late, to defend the trees, which they now know to be in danger. Now do those Noldorli confirm their fears, saying how Melkor is indeed the author of the mischief, and they have but one desire, and that is to lay hands upon him and his accomplices ere they can escape beyond the mountain. Tulkas is in the van of that great hunt, leaping sure-footed in the dimness, and Orome may not keep up with him, for even his divine steed cannot rush as headlong in the gathering night as does Poldoria in the fire of his wrath. Ulmo hears the shouting in his house in Vai, and Ossi thrusteth his head above the shadowy seas, and seeing no longer any light come down the valley of Kor, he leaps upon the beach of Eldamar, and runs in haste to join the Ainur in their hunt. Now is the only light place left in Valinor, that garden where the golden fountain sprang from Cululin, and then were Vana and Nessa and Urwen, and many maids and ladies of the Valar in tears. But Palurian girds her lord as he stands impatiently, and Varda has ridden forth from Taniquetil by her lord's side, bearing a blazing star before him as a torch. Telimektar, son of Tulkas, is with those noble ones, and his face and weapons gleam as silver in the dark. But now all the gods and all their folk ride this way and that, and some have hasty torches in their hands, so that the plain is full of pale, wandering light, and the sound of voices hallooing in the dusk. Even as Melko speeds away, a vanguard of the chase sweeps by the trees, and well nigh the valley faint for anguish at the ruin they see there. But now Melko and certain of his comrades, aforetime children of Mandos, are separated from Ungwe, who, wrapped in night, gets her gone southward and over the mountains to her home, nor does their chase ever draw nigh to her. But the others flee northward with great speed, for Melko's comrades have knowledge of the mountains there, and hope to get him through. There came a place at length where the shadow veils were thin, and they were viewed by a scattered band of the valley, and Tulkas was amongst them, who now with a great roar leaps at them. Indeed, it might have come to battle upon the plain, betwixt Tulkas and Melko, had not the distance been over great, so that even as Tulkas gained to within spear-cast of Melko, a belt of mist took the fugitives again, and the mocking laugh of Melko seems to come first from one side and then from the other, now from his elbow almost, now from far ahead, and Tulkas turns wildly about, and Melko slips away. Then Makar and Mease rode in all haste north with their folk, arousing Mandos and ordering the guarding of the mountain paths. But either Makar was too late, or Melko's cunning defeated him, and the mind of Makar was not over-subtle, for no glimpse of that Ainu did they see, though assuredly he did escape that way, and worked much evil after in the world, yet none are there whom I have heard tell ever of the manner of his perilous flight back to the ice kingdoms of the north. Notes. 1. See The Coming of the Elves, Side 5. 2. Lirillo appears in the list of secondary names of the Valar, referred to in The Coming of the Valar, Side 4, as a name of Salmar Noldorin. 3. Father of Feanor is the final reading, after a prolonged hesitation between Son of Feanor and Brother of Feanor. 4. For the story of the taking of rock and stone from Arvalin, Eruman, for the raising of the mountains of Valinor, see The Coming of the Valar, Side 3. 5. Sire of Feanor is an emendation from Son of Feanor, see Note 3. 6. After the word fabrics, there stood the following sentence, which was struck through, which the gods could, and they listed, have created in an hour, a sentence notable in itself and also for its excision. 7. The manuscript page, beginning with the words Before the gates of Valmar, and ending with Unabashed uttered his message, saying, is written round the little world map reproduced and described in The Coming of the Valar, Side 3. 8. In this part of the tale, the manuscript consists of detached passages with directions from one to another. The place of this sentence is not perfectly clear, but seems most probably to belong here. 9. The dots are in the original. 10. Afterward is an emendation from of old. A question mark is written in the margin against this sentence. Changes made to names in The Theft of Melko and the Darkening of Valinor. Elu Melemno, capital E-double-L-U, capital M-E-L-E-M-N-O, changed from Melemno in The Coming of the Elves, Side 5. In an added sentence, the leader of the Solosimpi is Elu, capital E-double-L-U. Sirnumen, capital S-I-R-N-U-M-E-N, changed from Numesir, capital N-U-M-E-S-S-I-R, at the first two occurrences. Subsequently, Sir Numen was the form first written. Eruman changed from Harmalin, changed from Habanan. Arvalin changed from Harvalian, changed from Habanan, changed from Harvalian, changed from Harmalin. Arvalian, capital A-R-V-A-L-I-E-N, thus first written. Bruithwir, capital B-R-U-I-T-H-W-I-R, replaces an earlier name, probably Maron, capital M-A-R-O-N. Bruithwir Gomaidros, G-O hyphen capital M-A-I-D-R-O-S, changed from Bruithwir Gofeanor, G-O hyphen capital F-E-A-N-O-R. G-O hyphen is a patronymic, son of, see notes 3 and 5 above. Moru, capital M-O-R-U, this name could equally well be read, as also at its occasional occurrences elsewhere, as Morn, capital M-O-R-N, see the appendix on names. It replaces here another name, probably Mordi, capital M-O-R-D-I. Ungoliant, capital U-N-G-O-L-I-O-N-T, changed from Gungliant, capital G-U-N-G-L-I-O-N-T. Daurin, capital D-A-U-R-I-N. Torin, in brackets, capital T-O-R-I-N. The original reading at the first occurrence was Feanor, changed to, question mark, Dauras, capital D-A-U-R-L-A-S, gap in text, akin to Feanor, and then to a gnome called Daurin Torin. The subsequent occurrences of Daurin are emendations of Feanor. Commentary on the Theft of Melko and the Darkening of Valinor. The story of the corruption of the Noldoli by Melko was ultimately told quite differently, for there entered the matter of the strife between Finwë's sons, Feanor and Fingolfin, the Silmarillion, page 69, of which in the tale there is no trace, and where, in any case, Feanor is not the son of Finwë Noleme, but of one Bruithwir. The primary motive in the later story of Melkor's desire for the Silmarils, in the same place, page 67, is here represented only by a lust for the gems of the Noldoli in general. It is indeed a remarkable feature of the original mythology that though the Silmarils were present, they were of such relatively small importance. There is essential agreement with the later story in its being the Noldoli at whom Melko aimed his attack, and there is a quite close, if limited, similarity in the arguments he used. The confinement of the elves in Valinor by the Valar, and the broad realms in the east that were rightly theirs, but notably absent from Melko's words, is any reference to the coming of men. This element is in the tale introduced later, and quite differently by Manwë himself. Moreover, the particular association of the Noldoli with the evil Valar arises from his desire for their gems. In the Silmarillion, page 66, the Noldor turned to him for the instruction he could give, while the other kindreds held aloof. From this point the narratives diverge altogether, for the secret evil of Melkor was in the Silmarillion laid bare as a result of the inquiry held into the quarrel of the Noldorin princes, whereas here its revelation came about more simply from the anxiety of Finwë Noleme about the unrest of his people. The later story is of course far superior, in that Melkor was sought by the Valar as a known enemy as soon as his machinations were uncovered, though he escaped, whereas in the tale, despite there being now every evidence that he was by no means reformed, he was merely told to go and think things over in Mandos. The germ of the story in the Silmarillion of Feanor's banishment to Formenos, where he was accompanied by Finwë, is present, though here the entire people of the Noldoli are ordered to leave Kor for the rugged dale northwards, where the stream Hiri plunged underground, and the command to do so seems to have been less a punishment meted out to them by Manwë than a precaution and a safeguard. In connection with the place of the banishment of the Noldoli, here called Sir Numen, Western Stream, it may be mentioned that in an isolated note found in the little book referred to in the Cottage of Lost Play, side 1, it is stated, the river of the second rocky dwelling of the gnomes in Valinor was Kelusindi, and the spring at its source Kapalinda. Very remarkable is the passage where Manwë is said to know that the elves were children of the world and must one day return to her bosom. As I have noticed earlier, the coming of the Valar, side 3, the world is often equated with the great lands, and this usage occurs repeatedly in the present tale, but it is not clear to me whether this sense is intended here. I incline to think that the meaning of the phrase is that at the great end, the Eldar, being bound to the earth, cannot return with the Valar and spirits that were before the world, the coming of the Valar, side 3, to the regions whence they came, compare the conclusion of the original music of the Ainur, side 3. Coming to the account of the theft of the jewels, the structure of the narrative is again radically different from the later story, in that there Melkor's attack on the Noldor of Formenos, the theft of the Silmarils and the slaying of Finwë, was accomplished after his meeting with Ungoliant in the south and the destruction of the two trees. Ungoliant was with him at Formenos. Nor in the earliest version is there any mention of Melkor's previous visit to Formenos, the Silmarillion, pages 71-2, after which he passed through the Kalakiria and went northwards up the coast, returning later in secret to Avatar, Arvalin, Eruman, to seek out Ungoliant. On the other hand, the great festival was already the occasion for Melkor's theft of the Silmarils from the dwelling of the Nololi, though the festival was wholly different in having a purely commemorative purpose, see the Silmarillion, pages 74-5, and it was a necessary part of that purpose that the Solar Simpi should be present. In the Silmarillion, only the Teleri beyond the mountains still sang upon the shores of the sea, for they recked little of seasons or times. Of Melkor's dark accomplices out of Mandos, some of them said to be aforetime children of Mandos, there is no trace later, nor of his theft of Orome's horses, and while Melkor is here said to have wished to leave Valinor by passes over the northern mountains, but to have thought better of it, leading to a reflection on what might have been the fate of Valinor had he not, in the later story his movement northwards was a feint. But it is interesting to observe the germ of the one in the other, the underlying idea never lost of a northward and then a southward movement, even though it takes place at a different point in the narrative and has a different motivation. Interesting also is the emergence of the idea that a close kinsman of Fëanor's, only after much hesitation between brother and son becoming fixed on the father, was slain by Melkor in the dwelling of the Nololi, Sir Numen, precursor of Formenos, but the father had yet to be identified with the lord of the Nololi. In this passage there are some slight further geographical indications. The two trees stood to the north of the city of Valmar, as they are shown on the map, see the coming of the Valar, side 3, and again, in agreement with the map, the great lands and the outer lands came very close together in the far north. Most notably, the gap in the mountains of Valinor, shown on the map and which I marked with the letter E, is now explained, the low place in the hills by which Melkor and his following passed out of Valinor into Arvalin Eruman, a gap left by Turkas and Aule for their own entry into Valinor at the time of the raising of the mountains. Of the next part of this tale, almost nothing survived. Manwë's lecture to the Nololi disappeared, but some of its content is briefly expressed at another place in the narrative of the Silmarillion, page 68. The Noldor began to murmur against the Valar, and many became filled with pride, forgetting how much of what they had and knew came to them in gift from the Valar. Manwë's naming of Fëanor's father, Gruithwyr, by the patronymic Gomaidros, is notable, though the name Maidros was subsequently to be that of Fëanor's eldest son, not of his grandfather. It was from the outset associated with the Fëanorians. There is no trace later of the strange story of the renegade servant of Mandos, who brought Melkor's outrageous message to the Valar, and who was hurled to his death from Taniquetil by the irrepressible Tulkas, in direct disobedience to Manwë, nor of the sending of Sorontur to Melkor as the messenger of the gods. It is not explained how Sorontur knew where to find him. It is said here that afterwards Sorontur and his folk fared to the Iron Mountains, and there abode, watching all that Melkor did. I have noticed, in commenting, side 4, on the chaining of Melkor, that the Iron Mountain, said to be south of Hissilome, side 4, and the coming of the elves, side 5, there correspond to the later mountains of shadow, Ered Wethrin. On the other hand, in the tale of the sun and moon, side 7, Melkor, after his escape from Valinor, makes himself new dwellings in that region of the north where stand the Iron Mountains, very high and terrible to see, and in the original tale of Turambar, it is said that Angband lay beneath the roots of the northernmost fastnesses of the Iron Mountains, and that these mountains were so named from the hells of iron beneath them. Footnote. Tale of Turambar. The actual title of this tale is The Tale of Turambar and the Foaloke, the Foaloke being the dragon. End of footnote. The statement in the present tale that Sorontur watched all that Melko did from his abode in the Iron Mountains obviously implies likewise that Angband was beneath them, and the story that Sorondor, had his eyries on Thangorodrim before he removed them to Gondolin, survived long in the Silmarillion tradition. See Unfinished Tales, page 43, and note 25. There is thus, apparently, a contradictory usage of the term Iron Mountains within the Lost Tales, unless it can be supposed that these mountains were conceived as a continuous range, the southerly extension, the later Mountains of Shadow, forming the southern fence of Hitilome, while the northern peaks, being above Angband, gave the range its name. Evidence that this is so will appear later. In the original story, the Noldali of Sir Numen were given permission, through the intercession of Arle, to return to Kor, but Feanor remained there in bitterness with a few others, and thus the situation of the later narrative, the Noldor in Tirion, but Feanor at Formenos, is achieved with the element absent of Feanor's banishment and unlawful return to the city of the elves. An underlying difference to be noted is that in the Silmarillion, pages 61 to 2, the Vanyar had long since departed from Tirion and gone to dwell on Taniquetil or in Valinor. Of this there is no suggestion in the old tale, and of course there is the central structural difference between the early and late narratives, when Feanor raises his standard of rebellion, the trees are still shining in Valinor. In the tale, a good while seems to elapse, after the loss of the treasures of the Noldali, during which they set to work again with lessened joy, and Feanor sought in vain to remake the Silmaril. This element must, of course, disappear in the later, much tauter structure, where Feanor, refusing to hand over the Silmarils to the Valar for the healing of the trees, and not yet knowing that Melko has taken them, knows without attempting it that he cannot remake them any more than Yavanna can remake the trees. The embassage of Feanor and other Noldali to Manwë, demanding that the gods ferry them back to the great lands, was excised, and with it Manwë's remarkable instruction to them concerning the coming of men, and his expressed reluctance to have the Eldar return to the world while men were still in their infancy. No such idea is represented in the Silmarillion as being in Manwë's mind, nor is there any suggestion that Manwë's knowledge was so great, and indeed, where in the old story it was Manwë's very description of men and account of his policy with regard to them that gave rise to Feanor's rhetoric against them, and which gave strong colour to his assertion of the Valar's true motive for bringing the Eldar to Valinor, in the Silmarillion, page 68, these ideas are a part of the lies of Melkor. I have noticed above that in Melkor's persuasions of the Noldali in the tale, there is no reference to the coming of men. An otherwise unknown element in the music of the Ainur is revealed in Manwë's words, that the world shall come in the end for a great while under the sway of men. In the original version, there are several suggestions, in reflective asides, that all was fated. So here the jealousy of elves and men is seen as perhaps a necessary part of the unfolding of the history of the world, and earlier in the tale it is asked, who shall say but that all these deeds, even the seeming needless evil of Melko, were but a portion of the destiny of old? But for all the radical changes in the narrative, the characteristic note of Feanor's rhetoric remained. His speech to the Noldali of Kor rises in the same rhythms as his speech by torchlight to the Noldor of Tirion, the Silmarillion, pages 82 to 3. In the story of Melko and Ungoliant, it is seen that essential elements were present ab initio. The doubt as to her origin, her dwelling in the desolate regions and the south of the outer land, her sucking in of light to bring forth webs of darkness, her alliance with Melko, his rewarding her with the gems stolen from the Noldoli, though this was differently treated later. The piercing of the trees by Melko and Ungoliant's sucking up the light, and the great hunt mounted by the Valar, which failed of its object through darkness and mist, allowing Melko to escape out of Valinor by the northward ways. Within this structure, there are, as almost always, a great many points of difference between the first story and the later version. In the Silmarillion, page 73, Melkor went to Avatar because he knew of Ungoliant's dwelling there, whereas in the tale she found him wandering there, seeking a way of escape. In the tale her origin is unknown, and though this element may be said to have remained in the Silmarillion, the Eldar know not whence she came, in the same place, by the device of "some have said," a clear explanation is in fact given, she was a being from before the world, perverted by Melkor, who had been her lord, though she denied him. The original idea of the primeval spirit Moru is made explicit in an entry in the early word list of the Gnomish language, where the name Moru is defined as a name of the primeval night personified as Gwerlum or Gungliant. Footnote: in the tale, the name Gungliant was originally written, but was amended to Ungoliant. End of footnote. The old story markedly lacks the quality of the description in the Silmarillion of the descent of Melkor and Ungoliant from Mount Yarmentir into the plain of Valinor, and there too the great festival of the Valar and Eldar was in progress at the time. Here it is long since over. In the Silmarillion, the assault on the trees came at the time of the mingling of the lights, page 75, while here Silpion was in full bloom, and the detail of the account of the destruction of the trees is rendered quite different through the presence of the gnome Daurin, afterwards abandoned without trace. Thus, in the old story, it is not actually said that Ungoliant drank the light of Silpion, but only that the tree died from her poison on Daurin's blade, with which Melko stabbed its trunk. And in the Silmarillion, Ungoliant went to the wells of Varda and drank them dry also. It is puzzling that the gnome was first named Feanor, since he was slain by Melko. It would seem that my father was at least momentarily entertaining the idea that Feanor would play no part in the story of the Noldoli and the Great Land. But in outlines for a later tale, Gilfanon's tale, The Travail of the Noldoli, side 9, he died in Mithrim. In this passage is the first appearance of Miruvor, defined in the early Kenya word list as nectar, drink of the Valar. With this, compare The Road Goes Ever On, page 61, where my father stated that it was the name given by the Valar to the drink poured at their festivals, and compared it to the nectar of the Olympian gods. In the translation of Namarie, he rendered Miruvore, nectar, in the same place, page 58. Most important of the differences in the tale is the immediate return of Ungoliant to her lair in the south, so that all the story in the Silmarillion, pages 80 to 81, of the thieves' quarrel, the rescue of Melkor by the Balrogs, and Ungoliant's coming into Nand Ungorteb, is absent from the narrative in the lost tales. The surrender of the gems of the Noldoli to Ungoliant takes place in the early version at the time of her first meeting with Melko. In the Silmarillion, he did not then possess them, for the attack on Formenos had not yet taken place. 7. The Flight of the Noldoli. Introduction. There is no break in Lindo's narrative, which continues on in the same hastily penciled form, and near this point passes to another similar notebook, clearly with no break in composition. But I have thought it convenient to introduce a new chapter or a new tale here, again taking the title from the cover of the book. The Flight of the Noldoli. Nonetheless, the gods did not give up hope, but many a time would meet beneath the ruined tree of Laurelin, and thence break and scour the land of Valinor, once more unwaringly, desiring fiercely to avenge the hurts done to their fair realm. And now the Eldar at their summons aided in the chase, that labours not only in the plain, but toils both up and down the slopes of the mountains, for there is no escape from Valinor to west, where lie the cold waters of the outer seas. But Feanor, standing in the square about Inwe's house in topmost core, will not be silenced, and cries out that all the Noldali shall gather about him and hearken, and many thousands of them come to hear his words, bearing slender torches, so that that place is filled with a lurid light such as has never before shone on those white walls. Now when they are gathered there, and Feanor sees that far the most of the company is of the kin of the Noldor, note one, he exhorts them to seize now this darkness and confusion, and the weariness of the gods to cast off the yoke, for thus demented he called the days of bliss in Valinor, and get them hence carrying with them what they might or listed. If all your hearts be too faint to follow, behold I, Feanor, go now alone into the wide and magic world to seek the gems that are my own, and perchance many great and strange adventures will there befall me, more worthy of a child of Ilúvatar than a servant of the gods. Note 2. Then is there a great rush of those who will follow him at once, and though wise Nolame speaks against this rashness, they will not hear him, and ever the tumult groweth wilder. Again Nolame pleads that at least they send an embassy to Manwë to take due farewell, and maybe get his good will and counsel for their journeying. But Feanor persuades them to cast away even such moderate wisdom, saying that to do so were but to court refusal, and that Manwë would forbid them and prevent them. "What is Valinor to us," say they, "now that its light is come to little? As leaf and lever would we have the untrammelled world." Now then they arm themselves as best they may, for not elves nor gods in those days bethought themselves over much of weapons. And store of jewels they took, and stuffs of raiment, but all their books of their lore they left behind. And indeed, there was not much therein that the wise men among them could not match from memory. But Nolame, seeing that his counsel prevailed not, would not be separated from his folk, and went with them, and aided them in all their preparations. Then did they get them down the hill of Kor, lit by the flame of torches, and so faring in haste along the creek and the shores of that arm of the shadowy sea that encroached here upon the hills, they found the seaward dwellings of the Solosimpi. Editor's note, the next short section of the text was struck through afterwards. The words, "Insert the battle of Copas Alcalunten," written across it, and replaced by a rider. The rejected section reads, "The most of that folk were gone a-hunting with the gods, but some of those that remained they suaded to cast in their lot with them, as already had some of the Teleri, but of the Inwir none would hearken to their words. Now having nigh as many maids and women as of men and boys, albeit many, especially of the youngest children, were left in Kor and Sir Numen, they were at a loss, and in this extremity, being distraught with sorrows and wildered in mind, the Noldali did those deeds which afterwards they most bitterly rued, for by them was the displeasure laid heavily on all their folk, and the hearts even of their kindred were turned against them for a while. Coming upon Copas, where was a haven of great quiet, beloved of the Solosimpi, they seized all the ships of that people, and embarked thereon their womenfolk and children, and some few others wherewith were those of the Solosimpi who had joined them, for these had a skill in navigation. In this way, marching endlessly along the beach, that grew wilder and more evil going as it trended to the north, while the fleet coasted beside them not far out to sea, it has been said to me that the Noldali got them from Valinor. However, I know not the matter deeply, and maybe there are tales known to none of the gnome kin that relate more clearly the sad happenings of that time. Moreover, have I heard say..." The rider that replaces this passage was written carefully and very legibly in ink on separate sheets. At how great an interval of time, I cannot say. End of editor's note. The Kin Slaughter, Battle of Copas Alcalunten. The most of that folk were gone a-hunting with the gods, but many there were gathered about the beaches before their dwellings, and dismay was abroad among them. Yet still were no few busy about the places of their ships, and the chief of these was that one they named Copas, or more fully, Copas Alcalunte, the haven of the swan ships. Footnote. In the margin is written Ielfetit. This is Old English, representing the interpretation of the Elvish name made by Eriol in his own language. The first element, meaning swan, Ielfetu, and the second, later, Hythe, meaning haven, landing place. End of footnote. Now, Swan Haven was like a basin of quiet waters, save that towards the eastward and the seas the ring of rocks that enclosed it sank somewhat, and there did the sea pierce through, so that there was a mighty arch of living stone. So great was this, that save of the mightiest ships two might pass there through, one going out maybe, and another seeking inward to the quiet blue waters of the haven, nor would the mast tops come nigh to grazing on the rock. Not much of the light of the trees came thither aforetime, by reason of the wall, wherefore was it lit ever with a ring of lamps of gold, and lanterns there were two of many colours, tokening the wharves and landings of the different houses. But through the arch the pale waters of the shadowy seas might distantly be glimpsed, lit faintly with the shining of the trees. Very beautiful was that harbour to gaze upon, what time the white fleets came shimmering home, and the troubled waters broke the mirrored radiance of the lamps into rippling lights, weaving strange patterns of many twinkling lines. But now were all those vessels lying still, and a deep gloom was settled on the place at the fading of the trees. Of the Solosimpi none would hearken to the wild words of the Nololi, save a few that might be counted on two hands. And so did that folk wander unhappily northward along the shores of Eldamar, even till they came to the cliff-tops that gazed down upon Swanhaven, and therefrom had the Solosimpi of old cut winding stairs in the rock leading down to the harbour's edge. Now northward thence the way was very rugged and evil, and the Nololi had with them nigh as many maids and women as of men and boys, albeit many especially of the youngest children were left in Kor and in Sir Numen, and many tears were shed thereat. Wherefore were they now at a loss, and in this extremity, distraught with sorrows and wildered in mind, they here wrought those deeds which afterwards they have most bitterly repented, for by them was for a while the displeasure of the gods laid heavily upon all their folk, and the hearts even of the Eldalie were turned against them. Behold, the counsel of Fëanor is that by no means can that host hope to win swiftly along the coast, save by the aid of ships. And these, said he, and the shore elves will not give them, we must take. Wherefore, going down to the harbour, they essayed to go upon those ships that there lay, but the Solosimpi said them nay, yet for the great host of the gnome folk they did not as yet resist. But a new wrath awoke there between Eldar and Eldar, so did the Nololi embark all their women folk and children, and a great host beside upon those ships, and casting them loose, they oared them with a great multitude of oars towards the seas. Then did a great anger blaze in the hearts of the shoreland pipers, seeing the theft of those vessels that their cunning and long labours had fashioned, and some there were that the gods had made of old on Tolaresia, as has been recounted, wondrous and magic boats, the first that ever were. So sprang up suddenly a voice among them, "Never shall these thieves leave the haven in our ships." And all those of the Solosimpi that were there ran swiftly atop of the cliff wall to where the archway was, where through that fleet must pass. And standing there they shouted to the gnomes to return. But these heeded them not, and held ever on their course. And the Solosimpi threatened them with rocks, and strung their elfin bows. Seeing this, and believing war already to be kindled, came now those of the gnomes, who might not fare aboard the ships, but whose part it was to march along the shores, and they sped behind the Solosimpi, until coming suddenly upon them nigh the haven's gate, they slew them bitterly, or cast them in the sea. And so first perished the Eldar, neath the weapons of their kin. And that was a deed of horror. Now the number of the Solosimpi that fell was very many, and of the gnomes not a few, for they had to fight hard to win their way back from those narrow cliff-top paths, and many of the shoreland folk, hearing the affray, were gathered in their rear. At length, however, it is done, and all those ships have passed out to the wide seas, and the Noldoli fared far away, but the little lamps are broken, and the haven is dark and very still, save for the faint sound of tears. Of like kind were all the works of Melko in this world. Now tells the tale that as the Solosimpi wept, and the gods scoured all the plain of Valinor, or sat despondent neath the ruined trees, a great age passed, and it was one of gloom, and during that time the gnome folk suffered the very greatest evils, and all the unkindliness of the world beset them, for some marched endlessly along that shore, until Eldamar was dim and forgotten far behind, and wilder grew the ways, and more impassable, as it trended to the north. But the fleet coasted beside them, not far out to sea, and the shorefarers might often see them dimly in the gloom, for they fared but slowly in those sluggish waves. Yet of all the sorrows that walked those ways, I know not the full tale, nor have any told it, for it would be an ill tale, and though the gnomes relate many things concerning those days more clearly than I can, yet do they in no wise love to dwell upon the sad happenings of that time, and will not often awake its memory. Nonetheless, have I heard it said? Editor's note. The inserted rider ends here, and we return to the original, roughly penciled text. End of editor's note. That never would they have made the dreadful passage of the Kerkaringa, note 3, had they or yet been subject to weariness, sickness, and the many weaknesses that after became their lot, dwelling far from Valinor. Still was the blessed food of the gods and their drink rich in their veins, and they were half divine, but no limpe had they as yet to bring away, for that was not given to the fairies until long after, when the march of liberation was undertaken, and the evils of the world which Melko poisoned with his presence soon fell upon them. Nay, if thou wilt forgive me bursting in upon thy tale, quoth Ariel, what meaneth thy saying, the dread passage of the Kerkaringa? Know then, said Lindo, that the trend of the coasts of Eldamar and those coasts that continued that strand northward beyond the wide haven of Copath is ever to the east, so that after uncounted miles, more northward even than the mountains of iron, and upon the confines of the icy realms, the great seas, aided by a westerly bend of the shores of the great lands, dwindle to a narrow sand. Now the passage of that water is of impassable peril, for it is full of evil currents and eddies of desperate strength, and islands of floating ice swim therein, grinding and crashing together with a dread noise, and destroying both great fish and vessels. Do any ever dare to venture there? In those days, however, a narrow neck, which the gods after destroyed, ran out from the western land almost to the eastern shores, yet it was of ice and snow, pillared and torn into gaps and cliffs, and was all but untraversable, and that was the Helcaraxe, or Ice Fang, note 4, and it was a remnant of the old and terrible ices that crept throughout those regions ere Melko was chained and the north became clement for a while, and it maintained itself there by reason of the narrowness of the seas and the jamming of the ice isles floating down from the deepest north, whither winter had withdrawn. Now that strip of water that flowed still between Icefang's tip and the great lands was called Kerkaringa, or Chill Gulf, note 5. Had Melko indeed known of the gnome's wild attempt to cross it, he might have overwhelmed them all in that ill place, or done whatso he willed. But many months had gone since he himself had fled, perchance, by that very way, and he was now far afield. Say I not well, Rumil, with regard to these things? Thou hast told the true tale, said Rumil. Yet hast thou not said, how ere they came to Helcaraxa, the host passed by that place where Mornier is wont to be beached. For there a steep and rugged path winds down from Mandos, deep in the mountains that the souls whom Fui sends to Arvalin must tread. Note 6. There did a servant of Vefantor spy them, and asking what might that wayfaring mean, pled with them to return. But they answered him scornfully, so that standing upon a high rock, he spoke to them aloud, and his voice came even to the fleet upon the wave, and he foretold to them many of the evil adventures that after came to them, warning them against Melko. And at last he said, "Great is the fall of Gondolin, and none there understood, for Turondo, son of Noleme, note 7, was not yet upon the earth." But the wise men stored his sayings, for Mandos and all his people have a power of prophecy, and these words were treasured long among them as the prophecies of Amnos, for thus was the place where they were spoken called at that time, which now is Hanstovanen, note 8, or the beaching place of Mornier. After that the Noldoli journeyed slowly, and when the awful isthmus of Helcaraxa was before them, some were for ferrying all the host, part at a time, across the sea, venturing rather over the perilous waters than seeking to find passage over the gulfs and treacherous crevasses of the isthmus of ice. This they tried, and a great ship was lost with all aboard, by reason of a certain fearsome eddy that was in the bay, nigh where Helcaraxa jutted from the western mainland. And that eddy at times spins around like a vast top, and shrieks with a loud wailing noise most terrible to hear, and such things as approach are sucked down to its monstrous deep, and crushed there upon jags of ice and rock. And the name of the eddy is Wirwin. Wherefore are the Noldoli in great anguish and perplexity? For even could they find a way through the terrors of the Helcaraxa, behold, they cannot even so reach the inner world, for still there lies that gap at the far end. And though but narrow, the screech of water rushing therethrough can be heard thus far away, and the boom of ice splitting from the cape came to them, and the crash and buffet of the ice isles that thrust down from the north through that dreadful strait. Now the presence of those floating isles of ice no doubt was due to the presence of Melko once more in the far north, for winter had retreated to the uttermost north and south, so that almost it had no foothold in the world remaining in those days of peace that are called Melko's chains. But nonetheless it was this very activity of Melko that in the end proved the salvation of the Noldoli, for behold, they now are constrained to lead all their women folk and the mariners of their host out of the ships, and there on those bleak shores they beach them, and set now a miserable encampment. Songs name that dwelling, note 9, the Tents of Murmuring, for there arose much lamentation and regret, and many blamed Fëanor bitterly, as indeed was just, yet few deserted the host, for they suspected that there was no welcome ever again for them back to Valinor. And this some few who sought to return indeed found, though this entereth not into this tale. When their woes are now at the blackest, and scarce any look for return of any joy again, behold, winter unfurls her banners again, and marches slowly south, clad in ice with spears of frost and lashes of hail. Yet so great is the cold, that the floating ice packs and jams and piles like hills between the end of Helcaraxa and the eastern land, and in the end does it become so strong that the current moves it not. Then abandoning their stolen ships, they leave their sorrowful encampment and strive to cross the terrors of the Kerkaringa. Who shall tell of their misery in that march, or of those numbers who were lost, falling into great pits of ice, where far below hidden water boiled, or losing their way until cold overcame them, for evil as it was, so many and desperate